Okay, so what we're going to try to do is outline the conceptual, the different conceptual models for understanding mukta. Now, throughout this, there are passages from different people's notes from Shirim Bar Lichtenstein. Just to answer it right up front, I was at the Shirim. I was in Raron Shir for Beitza. But these are not my notes, because my notes are not as good as some of them are Udi Schwartz's. If you know Udi, you know Udi. So his notes are much better than mine, and some other people. But I can attest that he did say these things, so I was what was there. And for the most part, the basic contours of what I'm going to say are from those Shirim that I heard from Lichtenstein, however many years ago that was now. About 10, something like that. 10 years ago. 11. Okay. So... mukta. What exactly makes something mukta? Right. There are many different types of mukta, which Jorchina outlined last week, and we're going to go through. But what makes something mukta? And here there are several main directions that we can take. One direction is to say that mukta, as it sounds like, needs proactive rejection, right? The verb of, right, laktot, he's makteh midato, he sets it aside, meaning someone actively says, either explicitly, implicitly, however we want to formulate it, that this object is off limits for Shabbos. That's what makes something mukta. Now, there are certain muktas that really do sound that way. Right, like mukta machmas mius. Right, it's mukta because it's disgusting. So therefore, people stay away from it. And it sounds like either explicitly or implicitly, this object was set aside, was pushed aside for Shabbos. The other extreme is to say no, mukta isn't about active setting aside, right, or removing something from the realm of usage on Shabbos, but on the contrary. Everything is presumed to be mukta unless you have reason to believe that it has been prepared, that it has been taken into the realm of usage. Or another way of putting this is, what is the de facto state of objects? Is it that they are good for use on Shabbos unless we have reason to push them out? Or they're bad unless we have reason to pull them in? Do I need to proactively bring them into the sphere of human usage? Or, in order for them to be problematic, do I have to actively push them out? Now, again, some of these lines will be blurred. This will be blurred because we will see that not everything will be implicit. Explicit. A lot of it will be implicit, right? Won't necessarily be, right? No one before Shabbos goes to every object they're going to use and says, I'm going to use this, I'm not going to use this, I'm going to use this, I'm not going to use this, and no one requires that. So much of it is going to be implicit. This is the type of thing that I can presume to use or people will use. But this will be important. So that's the sources that we have here. Now, there are other models, and we'll come to them in a minute. So let's start with the first model. That it is that mukta needs... Well, the second one that I said, but now we'll do the first one. We'll put it first. Because Rabbi Jorchina already mentioned it in passing last week, that mukta is a function of hachana, namely that everything is presumed to be forbidden unless it is prepared, it is actively brought into the realm of human experience before Shabbos. Now, what sources would indicate that this might be true? So, if you wanted to say this, the best way to say it would be that mukta is a function of what we know as hachana dirabba, which is presented in number one, where the Gemara in Beitza at the beginning says, Elamar Rabba la'olam tarnagolas ha'omedes la'achila. The Gemara is trying to figure out why an egg born on Yom Tov is forbidden. The Gemara goes through many possibilities, but in the middle of that discussion, the Gemara says, we're talking about a hen that laid the egg, and the hen was meant to be eaten. We're talking about Yom Tov that falls on Sunday. Now, why is this egg, which is born on Sunday forbidden? The Gemara says, because of Hachana. What is this rule called Hachana? Of preparation. Ksava Rabba, kol beitza de misyaldaha idna me'esmal gamrala. Rabba believes that an egg that's born on Sunday was in the process of being formed or finishing being formed on Shabbos. V'rabba l'taimei, and Rabba therefore follows his own reasoning and says this is problematic. To Omar Rabba, because Rabba believes that my dechziv haya b'yom ha'shishi v'echino es ha'shir aviyu. In the context of the month, we say that on the day on Friday, they prepared everything they would bring. What do we learn from this pasuk that you prepared for Shabbos on Friday? Chol mechen l'Shabbos v'chol mechen l'yom tov. You can prepare, or you must prepare, on a non-holy day for Shabbos and for Yom Tov. V'ein Yom Tov mechen l'Shabbos, v'ein Shabbos mechina l'Yom Tov. But you can't prepare from a holy day to a holy day. So Rabba therefore contends that there is an active obligation to prepare that which you're going to use on Shabbos on a weekday, right? And not from a Yom Kodesh to Yom Kodesh. Now, this says nothing about Muktzah at first glance. All it says is that if you have Shabbos going into Yom Tov or Yom Tov going to Shabbos, then you can have something prepared from the Yom Kodesh to the Yom Kodesh. But it doesn't say anything about Muktzah. But Rashi believes that this is the source that Muktzah is Daraisa. Number two, L'taymei Dama Rabba B'Psachem V'Yolof Me'acha the Muktzah Daraisa. By connecting them, based on the Gemara in Psachem, which Rabbi Tarchiner brought last week, Rashi tells you that Muktzah is a function of Hachana. In what sense is Muktzah a function of Hachana? What it seems to be is that Rashi assumes that what does it mean that something is Muktzah? It means that it wasn't actively prepared before Shabbos. Now, obviously, as we said, you don't go over your suit and you say, I'm going to wear this suit on Shabbos, right? And then what, if you get a stain on your suit, you can't wear your different suit on Shabbos, right? No one ever said that. So what could Rashi mean by saying that Muktzah is the function of Hachana? So presumably he means this in an implicit sense, right? There are things which by their very definition are presumed. You'll be using them on Shabbos because they're usable. Clothes, food, whatever, books, right? Take your pick. Things that are normally used on Shabbos, no one has to actively prepare them because they are in a perpetual state of presumed Hachana. Right, humanity has set them has already prepared them. This is what we use on Shabbos. This is what we use every day, and there's no malacha problem. So why wouldn't we use them? And they're the type of thing we need on Shabbos. But certain things we will see do need to be set aside. So, for example, right, things which are normally used l'isser, right, which are normally used for forbidden uses, or no. Not forbidden uses, things that normally have no use. Eitzim v'avanim, right? One of the cases of muktzah, right? Sticks and stones. They have no purpose on Shabbos. So they're muktzah. What if you want to use a rock as a paperweight? So then the halacha is, you need to set it aside before Shabbos and say, this is a paperweight. Now, how do you do that? Do you do it verbally, physically? Will be something we'll get to. But sticks and stones, which are not presumed to have any use whatsoever, in order for them not to be muktzah on Shabbos, they need to be set aside before. So, while clothes and food you may not need to set aside because they're presumed prepared, they're presumed mukhan, things which are not presumed mukhan, you need to actively be mechan. And Rashi seems to view all of muktzah in this light, that what makes something muktzah is not that it was actively pushed aside, but on the contrary. In order for something not to be muktzah, it needs to have actively been brought into the realm of human experience. Many things are presumed in the realm of human experience, and therefore they're never muktzah. And then there are things which are presumed outside the realm of normal human usage, and those things need active hachana before Shabbos. And then there are the things in sort of the middle, right? Like kli shemalachto le'isur, right? A hammer, which is normally used for forbidden things, but can be used to crack open nuts. So the halacha is, it's muktzah unless you're actually going to use it for a heter purpose, because it's an ambiguous state, right? It's possibly usable on Shabbos, but only if you're going to use it for the right things. But that seems to be Rashi's perspective. Now, we already noted that what exactly does it mean that muktzah is d'oraisa? So the Chasam Sofer in two places, both in his Tshuva and Aleph Ayin Tes in number 3, as well in the Hakdama to Beitza in Medar Tinyana, which Roy Tirchiner brought last week, suggests that Rashi only thinks this for Achila and not for Tilto, right? Noro Nifleti Al Mafarshim Iskim Mod Kvod Taratoshik Chumei Ashas Kamer Tilto Darabanan VaRabat Svir LeAchana DaReisa. Right, I saw that people asked about this position of Rabba. How can you say that moving things is only Darabanan? Rabba holds that Achana is biblical. Osan Mafarshim Stum Menam Mafurashim Lachol Muktzahu Iser DaReisa Dabay Achana Lachila Shabbos VeYom Tov. So, but when you actually look at him inside, you see how he formulates it. He said, why is it that food is DaReisa? Because we have a pasuk that tells you that food needs hachana. And therefore, food which is muktza is the bittul on a biblical level of Rabbah. Right? Because if you think, like Rashi, and the Chasam Sofer interpretations of Rashi according to Rabbah, that muktza comes from the active obligation to prepare things before Shabbos for Shabbos use, and otherwise they are going to be outside the realm of human usage, so the only biblical evidence we have is that eating something which is not prepared is usur. And therefore he says that maybe it's only food. But moving is just going to be dirabanan, or whatever exactly you think the status of a takanas nechemya is. But maybe eating is also only rabbinic, etc. Now, even if we don't paskin like Rashi, that mukta is daraisa, that doesn't mean that we can't take Rashi, that we can't take this general approach and say that on a rabbinic level, mukta is that which was not actively prepared before Shabbos. And the Chasam Sofer in 4 also adds just a slight comment on this, which helps our understanding. He writes as follows: Ein mashkos v'tzlach v'zeh davar charif. Ani mistapek ishayach muktza biyom kippurim min haTorah deveichinu as asher yaviu biroma habiyom haroi lachila ka'amar. If you really think that where does mukta come from on a biblical level? It's from the active obligation to prepare food. So what happens if it's Yom Kippur, in which there's no reason you would prepare food at all, right? There's no eating on that day. So then he says maybe mukta isn't min haTorah, because if there's no presumption that you have to prepare food, then if you didn't prepare food, it's also not off limits, right? So if mukta is a derivative of the obligation to prepare, and according to him, specifically food for Shabbos, then on a day where there's no presumption you'd prepare food, there also can't be mukta. Now, what that would mean, right? Not totally sure, right? Maybe, I mean, a nafkamina for kids, maybe, right? And animals and things like that. Yeah.
No, Yom Kippur, you're not allowed to eat. Who says you're not allowed to prepare food?
No, before. Right? He said if, right? He's saying if mukta is a derivative of the fact that I should have prepared the food before Shabbos and now I didn't. So what if there was no expectation I should have prepared food? So then maybe nothing can become muktza on a biblical level. Right, so that's sort of the Chasam Sofer's formulation. That's formulation one. And the other extreme is the position of the Me'iri. The Me'iri thinks that muktza is not about lack of preparation. It's about active haktza'ah. That something becomes muktza because I push it aside. Where does he get this notion? So the Gemara in Sukkah introduces a concept which, at first glance, is not really mukta. Right? The Gemara tells you as follows: Amar of Sheshes Mishum Rabbi Akiva, Minayin Latzeya Sukkah Shasurin Kol Shiva. How do you know that the wood of the Sukkah, the Schach, is forbidden for usage all 7 days? Talmud Lomar Chagas Sukkos Shivas Yamim LaShem. That Sukkot is a holiday for God. For 7 days, it's for God. Utanya Yehuda b'mzeira Omer, k'shem shechal shem shamayim ala chagiga, kach shechal shem shamayim ala Sukkah. Just like God's name has an effect on the karban, on the chagiga, it does on the Sukkah as well. Shnemar chagat Sukkos shivas yamim laHashem, ma chag laHashem. Just like the karban is for God, av Sukkah laHashem, it's designated for God. It's put aside for God, and therefore you can't use it. And that's why, right, if decorations fall off the schach, right, you can't use them, you can't use them, you can't touch them. Yeah, you can't move them on Sukkot. Now, this is some form of a mukta machmatz mitzvah type thing, though it's obviously more expansive. It applies all 7 days, even in Chol HaMoed, where prohibitions are generally more lax. But be that as it may, the Meiri, in the beginning of Beitzah, tells you that this is the source for all of mukta. V'tzarech ata leida, sha'amukta u'shem klali, l'chol ochel sha'achilaso muktzeit mida'ato shel adam. Mukta is a catch-all phrase for all things that are set aside, that are out of thought, out of mind. That you didn't think about before Yom Tov. The Ikar Isuro, where is its prohibition from? Everything is derived from this unique category of Mukta L'mitzvato of Sukkah, Kegon Noyi Sukkah, like the sukkah and its decorations, and noy sukkah's mitzvah shlo hidna lehen bin ashmashot gon etrog shel mitzvah lachila vahada shel mitzvah lariach gon atzei sukkah lana. All these different muktzas of mitzvah. Umuktza ze yotzalanu mimashen emar b'torah chagat sukkah tase lachashiv ad yamim lashem machag lashem av sukkah lashem. Milamid, what does this teach us? Shekshem shechal shem shamayim ala chagika kach chal shem shamayim ala sukkah. Just like God's name is on the carbon, it's on the sukkah. V'hu she'atzei sukkah asurin kol shiva. It means that the schach is asur for all of sukkahs. V'afilu nafla itzeh, even if the schach falls down, asurin mitoras mukta. It's mukta. V'afilu yachol shomoed. Even a chol moed she'ain bo mukta mach mastiris oel. It doesn't have the normal mukta because of taking down a building. You could. Mikol makom yesh ba mukta misad ha-mitzvah. V'hu anekra mukta le-mitzvato. The if it falls, it's asur because of muktzel mitzvato. Umuktzel isiro, and because it's forbidden. Ratzon machmat sir oel. Right, on Yom Tov, you have the added problem. You can't take down buildings. Umikanesu kol muktzin. And this is the source for all muktzah. Hein machmat chisaron gis. Whether it be things which are muksa because of loss of money, hein machmat isur machmat isur, or because it's forbidden, u machmat mios, or because it's disgusting, v'achirim mivara ilu, and others like this, shekol sha'adam misiach da'ato mimenu. Right, the Miri, you can't get much clearer. Anything, right, this is why people like joke, the Miri is like an achron, right? It's not like you don't have to make diukim, he just tells you what he thinks. Right, anything that you push out of your mind, right, or you don't think about, shalol achlobotos man, machmat isur sibat, for whatever reason, she daish mimenu, or that you gave up on it. Nikra mukta. It is mukta. Sha mukta ushem klali l'chol ochel she'ein daito she'odom alav achshav v'nechlak l'nanim rabim v'nim arukim me'od. And so therefore, Rav Lichtenstein argued that according to Meir, you see a different model. What makes something mukta is that it's pushed out of your mind actively in some sense. Now, the Meir is quite extreme because he thinks all mukta is like this. And the other possibility is also extreme, that there is no active haktzah. However, as we'll see, it's very possible that different muktzot function in different ways. Right? Mukta machmas mius, let's say, right? Something which is mukta because it's disgusting, right? May be more on the active side. On the other hand, nolad, maybe, right? Something which just didn't exist before Yom Tov. Well, if it didn't exist, it's harder to say that I actively pushed it out of thought, right? It just didn't exist. It just is the radical expression of lack of hachana, right? If it was born on Yom Tov, then I couldn't, by definition, have prepared it, right? So it may be that the muktos split, and it may be that many of the machlokot that we see in the Gemara and the Rishonim depends on this. Now, there is the third model for muksa, which doesn't really weigh in so much on this, which is the one we already saw a little bit of last week, which is the Ramban. And the Ramban, but the Ramban is the most explicit in it, who says that the source of mukta isn't hachana, nor is it mukta machmas mitzvah. It is an expression of the Torah's value of Shabbaton. Right? The Torah wants us to have a Shabbos-dik experience, and it's insufficient to simply avoid malacha. Therefore, the Torah tells you, in addition, you should have a general, you have a general obligation to make Shabbos-dik, give it the right ambiance. And mukta is a rabbinic expression of that. He formulates it as follows, in 7. This is his most, in all the places, he says it in multiple places, this is the most elaborate presentation in his drasha l'Rosh Hashanah. Havel hinyan kachu. Shenitzavenu min haTorah b'milat Shabbaton lihiyot lanu menucha b'yom tov. The word Shabbaton tells us you must rest on Yom Tov. Shelo nitrach afilu b'dvarim she'enan melacha. You can't exert yourself even in things that aren't melacha. Vim lo amar elo kol melechet avodah lo tasu. If it had only said don't do melechet avodah, don't do work things, hayim utar min haTorah kol torach va'amel she'en bo melacha mamish min avod v'toldehen. Any exertion which wasn't a melacha, either an av or a tolda, would have been permitted. You could have been exerting yourself all day. Limdora tvuot, measuring things, lishkala per vamatchot, weighing things, umalei chaviot yayin, ulfenot akelim va'orot, asherim va'kvazim va'karot, right? And you would have been filling up barrels and moving things, and skins, and v'gam avanim by the bite, and rocks. And if you're lucky enough to live in a place with an eruv, you could carry even outside your house, and you would be loading up your animals with fruits and wine. And the red would be business as normal. The stores would be open. The creditor would be crediting, would be, right, whatever. V'ashulchani yoshev al-shulchano, the money changer would be working. Azuim lefanav machlif. V'chein ha-po'alim yicholim lashkim l'malachtam yu maskirin atzmam kechol edvarim alo chayot. And workers would hire themselves out. V'utru yamim tovim v'afil ha-shabbat atzman yom tov, and Shabbos itself would be totally mutter. V'chol eilo en v'em lo av alach v'lo tol. They'd all be permitted. V'chizeu kavod shetziva katuv b'yom tov. Is this the honor that the Torah wants you to have of Yom Tov? V'oneg shetziva b'shabbat, or the enjoyment on Shabbos shelo yotzi gro gerit achad mi beit l'shur zarabim, that you shouldn't take out a dried fig into the from your house in l'shur zarabim. Aval yigalgel zevel shebechatzeru kol ayom, but instead you should spend all day taking out the garbage. Milamala lamato v'yamale mimenu kuporu mishpalat l'refet bakar, right? Clearing out the garbage and the dung in your animal pens, viyasiya avanim gdolot avanim ikarot avnei gazit viyatzev behem, and carry these rocks. Im kein eina shabbat menucha vein yamim tovim shabbaton v'divrei sofrim. But laikar kachu, rather it's like this: shehuz harno b'melechat shabbat b'lav v'karet b'chiyuv skila. Melacha on Shabbos is usher by the death penalty. And if you violate any malacha, small or big, you get killed. But mere exertion, and it doesn't have a malacha, we are enjoined to not do it because of the positive mitzvah of Shabbaton. Make Shabbos Shabbos dick. Ubiyom tov nami, and a yom tov is true, malachot belav, matorach ba'aseh azeh shu Shabbaton. Malacha is a regular lav, but exertion is an aseh, is a positive command. Klomar, yom menucha uvitul shenamod p'teilim v'nol na'aseh davar. Umimenu amar navi, v'chibato me'asot rechach, ha'mimso chavatzecha v'gomer. Ubo chachamim v'husifu b'shabbaton, and then Chazal came and added to this biblical mitzvah of Shabbaton, shlo yitaltel afilu evin ktana, that you shouldn't even carry a small rock, meaning muktza. And then he continues in this vein. So the Ramban tells you that muktza is an expression of Shabbaton. Now, Terchiner didn't touch on this last week, but I think Rabbi Yaakov Ariel's comment in 8 is very telling, because you have to ask the question, if there's a biblical mitzvah to make Shabbos Shabbos dick, then why did Chazal bother adding rabbinic restrictions? What is the connection between the biblical and the rabbinic command? So Rabbi Yaakov Ariel suggests an interesting possibility as follows. This is in the context of his discussion why electricity is forbidden on Shabbos. But he says as follows. It could be that on a biblical level, violating what we call the shvusim wouldn't violate. Why? Because let's say once a year, right? You're usually good. You spend your whole Shabbos going to shul, learning Torah, having meals, taking a nap, zo. But once a year, right, it happens that, you know, you're an accountant and it's tax season. You're not going to write. You're not going to do anything. But you really need to advise people. you're not going to, you know, you're going to try to avoid it, but you know, you're on call that if someone needs to ask you a question here or there, you know, the week right before April 30th, you do it. So is your Shabbos really destroyed? Right? You know, you're a backup for emergency questions, right? Is your Shabbos destroyed? Probably not. If you did it every week, or you did it for a whole Shabbos constantly, you went to work that Shabbos. You didn't just answer the emergency questions. But you went to work, so your Shabbos would be destroyed. So Rabbi Yaakov Ariel says that's the difference between the Daraisa and the Derabbanan. On a biblical level, you only violate Shabbaton when you've done so many weekday things that your Shabbos doesn't look like Shabbos. Chazal came along and said, to make sure that you don't get to that point, we don't even let you do it once. Right? Meaning, any act that in the conglomerate would ruin Shabbos, we forbid even one time. That's what he writes in 8. L'chein nir l'fiyan da'ati lomar, sh'gam ha'cholkim al'chazon ish, v'sovrim sh'ein ba'falat machshirim chashmaliyim mesuyamim el iser d'rabbanan, even if you think, right, electricity is only rabbinic prohibition, kavanatam rak b'havalat mikrit sh'machshir bodeh, they could only mean that if you use it once. But if you did it all day long, it would ruin it. So if we take Rav Yaakov Ariel's interpretation of Ramban, we have a third model. What is Mukta? Mukta is a gzera to ensure we never get to the biblical violation of Shabbaton. It's not quite Shabbaton, right? Shabbaton would be if we didn't have Mukta at all, meaning we spent all Shabbos schlepping. Mukta is Chazal's attempt at making sure that we don't get to that point by forbidding even individual acts. Now, if this is what Mukta is, so then, unlike the first two models, it's much harder to predict what's going to be Mukta and what's not, and when you're going to have exceptions and when not. Right? Because according to Rav Yaakov Ariel's interpretation of Ramban, Mukta is a gzera which prevents us from getting to a violation of Shabbaton. But why are there exceptions carved out? Because according to Rabbi Akariel's analysis, a single act of violating Mukta doesn't kill the spirit of the law. So it makes sense that sometimes Chazal are going to call that exceptions if keeping Mukta is more damaging to Shabbos than not keeping Mukta. So the first two models, the Hachana model and the Haktsa model, are a bit more predictive, even though they may have exceptions. The Ramban-esque model is less predictive, right? Because what he's really saying is that there's this meta-value called make Shabbos Shabbos dig. Mukta is part of a complicated scheme to make sure that's true, but there are exceptions because sometimes there are counterweights that make it worth, quote-unquote, violating Mukta.
Is this example of electricity not borderline this or Havara? Like, it's not an assay. Here we're doing Xera, so we shouldn't be over a lav. No, I don't understand how...
It's Xera and an assay. That's exactly what it is.
Electricity has no loss. There's no Havamina to say that it's Havara?
No, Rav Yaakov Ariel says that if you reject the Chazon Ish and you think like Rav Shlomo Zalman, then Mukta is not Daraisa. He thinks... Okay. What? Electricity. Electricity is not Daraisa. I mean, I didn't give the whole tshuva because that's an electricity share. But Rabbi Yaakov Ariel says, according to the Chazon Ish, electricity is also Daraisa. But he says, but even if you think like Rav Shlomo Zalman, that electricity isn't Daraisa per se, perpetual usage of electricity would be a violation of Shabbaton and would be a meta Daraisa. Right? That's his argument. It's a fascinating tshuva. But yes, this is within the positions that reject the Chazon Ish. Now, obviously, there are certain electricities that will be Daraisa, right? If I use electricity to perform a malacha, it's presumably Daraisa, right? Not always, right? I mean, Ritzi Pesach wasn't sure about this. He thought that if you plowed with an electric plow, it wasn't Daraisa. That's just weird, but fine, not important. I mean, it is important, but not for now.
What predictive value does this third theory have at all? Sort of sounds like you're saying...
It doesn't. I'm not saying it has predictive value. I'm saying... Now, of course, I'm saying it doesn't.
Can help you...
Correct. No, correct. That's why I said the first two have predictive value, and that's why Rav Lichtenstein... Now, okay, I should make clear. Rav Lichtenstein did not mention what I just said in the middle, because from a predictive model, the third model doesn't make any difference. But now let me qualify what I just said, which is that that's not necessarily true, because in halacha, we always often have to distinguish between motivation of the law and the format, the structure of the law. Now, it could be that all the Ramban is really saying is this is the motivation for the law, but the structure, the of the law. The actual format of the law takes one of the previous two models, in which case the svara won't be predictive, but I put this to be honest, because it could be that what you think mukta really is, right? I hate doing this as a brisker, right? But I do it for intellectual honesty, which is, as much as I'd like to say that the Ramban is only the motivation for the law, but the actual format of the law is one of the first two models which have predictive value, right? Namely, either Hachana or Haktza'a. It could be that it's not. Sometimes rabbinic laws aren't like that. They're not predictive because they were a hodgepodge of gzerot that are aimed at a certain meta value, and therefore there are exceptions as needed. You're right. That's why I said it. Right? That's why I said it, because for intellectual honesty, right? Now, we'll see that the truth is that when you actually go through the laws, there does seem to be a logic. It doesn't seem to be random. But I'm always hesitant of chakiras which are too neat and have absolute predictive value, because that's not how life works. That's not how law works, right? Jeffrey, I'm sure, can send me like 10 articles right afterwards. But law is not that neat, right? And I'm sure Jerry can too, right? Right? It's not always that neat, right? Sometimes a law should look this way, but we carve an exception not because they make eminent sense with the original reason. It's because as things came up, we carved out exceptions, and that's how law is. And you can't totally predict what the law is going to be, right? I in Canadian law, the example I always go back to is an article that I saw a few years ago, right? Was, this is totally off point, but Canada has very loose abortion laws, but has draconian laws on the choosing the sex of the child through PGD, right? Through pre-genetic diagnosis and screening, right? If you choose the sex of the child through PGD or PGS, right, it carries up to a 10-year prison sentence and $500,000 fine, right? And a doctor wrote at some point, it doesn't make any sense, right? I understand that the gzeirot against PGD are meant to avoid eugenics, right? But it's permitted in Canada to, once the child has been fertilized, right, once the embryo is fertilized, to see, is it a boy or a girl, and then to abort it and try again. That's legal, lechadchila. And the other one, it makes no sense. The answer is, you're right, it doesn't make sense. But sometimes law is weird because we don't actually expect, right, people to go and abort 10 children until they get the right sex. If we allowed PGD, we might be worried about it. So you're right, sometimes law is just not predictive, right? And muksa might be the same way. I have to admit that. And that's why I put it here. In 9 and 10, I just gave you from the Rav, from Rai Salvechik, he had a slightly different formulation of this. This is based on my Messer from Liechtenstein, which was that he had a mildly different formulation than the Rambam. And he said it's not Shabbat. There's another model to explain Mukta, which is as follows. The Gemara in Shavuos says, in the context of Yom Kippur, D'tanya, Yachol lo yehe Yom HaKippur mechaper elam kein mis'ayahit anebo. Right? You might think that Yom Kippur doesn't atone unless you suffered. Vikaru mikra kodesh, and you called it mikra kodesh. And then the Gemara goes on. So Tosfot said, what does it mean? What is this obligation to call Yom Kippur a mikra kodesh, to make it holy? So Rashi says, Peirush bekuntres shel kiblu lav biberchotav lomar mikadesh Yisrael v'yom ha-kippurim. Rashi says it means you didn't say the brachot. Ve'ein yireh l'ashchan brachot. So what are you talking about? Since when are brachot biblical? So Rabbeinu Tam says, "V'nir Rabbeinu Tam, karu mikra kodesh shemodeh shebeidin tichu, that you admit in not just like verbally, you acknowledge that it is holy, that Bezdin made it holy. How v'shovet mimalacha, and you rest from melacha b'shvil kedushat hayom, right? You rest." Not because you happen to rest, but you rest because it's Shabbos or because it's Yom Kippur. V'lo karu mikre kodesh she'eino shovet machmar kedusha hayom ela machmar she'mitatzel lasot melacha. It's not called resting if you rested because you're lazy. It's only called resting if you rest because it's Shabbos, right? It's like the Rambam by Ger Toshav, right? An ethical person who keeps all Sheva Mitzvah Be'noach because he believes in a God, right, according to the Rambam, is not a Ger Toshav. He's only a Ger Toshav if he keeps the seven mitzvot because he believes that Moshe was given the Torah at Sinai and keeps it because he believes that. Right? There's an active component to it. So I gave you in 11, I'm not going to read inside, but I gave you a summary of it from Reb Solovsky because I couldn't find a written source for it. But right, this is similar to the Rambam's notion that what is Mikra Kodesh? It's not enough to rest passively. You have to actively rest. Rav Lichtenstein quoted the same Masorah, but he said that the Rav extended it to Mukta. Right, that the reason there's Mukta is because merely not doing Malacha wouldn't create an active cognizance that I am resting. But if I can't pick things up, right? I accidentally leave my iPad on the couch, right? And now I have to, right, figure out, can I move it? How do I move it? Right? That creates a consciousness, right? And if you want a raya to it, this is not the Rav's raya, this is my raya, so you don't have to like it, right? One of my pet peeves in life, right, to show how successful Chazal were, but it's still one of my pet peeves, right, is that you go around, right, 90% of kids, when their parents want to tell them, don't do something which is Asr on Shabbos, it could be a Malacha Daraisa, right? Don't write, don't color, they say, Mukta! It's Mukta! Right? Because Mukta is what, right, is what defines our consciousness, right? Alon Shvut is the only place in the world, right, you know, where, you know, I don't know if the only place, but I remember, or and I saw this, that a kid was playing with an umbrella, right, like a six-year-old, and an adult walked by and said, why are you using the umbrella? It's Mahil. Okay, most kids don't know that, right? Most kids, we catch it on Mukta. But isn't it telling, right, that for people who aren't educated enough to know all the Malachot, and who don't expect their five-year-old kids to know all the Malachot, right, this is why, is more neurotic about it than I am, right? That our five-year-old, when he doesn't do the English job, is never Mukta, right? He doesn't cut his hair, he knows it's Gozes. He knows Kosev. Oh, you know, Malachot we teach him. Might be a bit neurotic, but there is a, whatever. I'm allowed to be idiosyncratic here. But the point is that Mukta may be this, right? It's that somewhat obsessive notion of Mukta that creates not a passive resting, but an active consciousness. Because, right, even when you're going to carry something, right, because it's carved into the heter, the laws of Mukta are what makes you think, right? Is this an exception to the rule, right? It's that which creates that consciousness. Okay.
That might just be in our more modern lifestyles.
Yachol yot, that it's in our more modern lifestyles, that it becomes particularly expressed this way. And, you know, look, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel makes that point, right? That it's in the modern world where we don't need to do malacha, that the Rabbanans are that much more effective. But as a raya to Chazal, right, I think, but it is telling, right? We now live in the world that the Ramban imagined, right? Yavo yom, you won't have to do anything, right? Right? You could sit on your couch and say, Alexa, do whatever, right? It can create all types of fun things, right? You know, who was I talking to? Oh, I was talking, yeah, you know, Dr. David from Clinton Park, right? He has Alexa, right? But he accidentally left it on when they went to Israel, right? And the, you know, some people like leave the TV on for part of the day to make people, you know, think there's people in the house. But the infomercials are like, order, whatever, and Alexa, so they came to their house and there were piles of things, right, that Alexa had ordered for them from their Amazon, right? We don't have to do anything. You could leave your house and leave the TV on and Alexa will do everything for you, right? We live in that world. If it weren't for the Derabanan, Shabbos would be kaput, right? It was hysterical, but it's a raya to this point. Okay, fine. So those are what I think are the three models to think about in Mukta, right? Two of them are predictive and one is not, or one and a half is not. Right? If Mukta is just Chazal construct, not just in terms of motivation, but in terms of the nature of the Gzeira, is a hodgepodge of laws that Chazal instituted. Hodgepodge has too much of a negative connotation. It's just a collection of laws that Chazal put together to ensure that we have an active rest on Shabbos. It's not necessarily going to be predictive because, you know, you may want the meta value, but sometimes you carve out exceptions due to necessity. If you think that the way they formulate it is either that we require you to prepare before Shabbos, or anything which you actively push out of your mind is Mukta, then there is a bit more of a predictive value to it. Now, what is the first place? Now, we will move a bit faster. This, but I'm not going to necessarily read everything inside, because I do want to try to finish this. I may have to do a little bit of an afterwards, but that's okay. This may, at first glance, explain the basic machlokas in Mukta. The number one machlokas in Mukta is there such a thing as Mukta? Right? That's machloket number one. And that's not Pashut. So you look at 14, The Gemara tells you as follows: Amar Rav Nachman gabei Shabbos, the Zadim Lantana Kavatei, the Rabbi Shimon, the Tnan Mechatchan at Blun Lefnei Behema Vnei Lefnei Aklavim Mokim La Lebeit Hillel Ki Rabbi Shimon. The Mishnah says that you're allowed to cut gourds for an animal and a dead animal for dogs, which means that there's no mukta, because normally an avela is not kosher, and therefore you're not going to use it. And yet you're allowed to throw it to the dogs on Shabbos, which tells you that there's no mukta. And Rabbi Shimon holds that there's no such thing as mukta. Aval gabe yom tov disatam lantana kerab Yehuda. But on yom tov, the Mishnah says there is mukta, like Rabbi Yehuda. Ditnan in mevakin etzim menakorot velomenakorash nishmrab yom tov mokim lave hilak Rabbi Yehuda. So the Gemara says, "Michti man sadmi lamatin Rebbe, who made the Mishnah Rebbe? Maishnad b'shabbat desadim lankar Rebbe Shimon. Why does Rebbe say there isn't mukta on Shabbos? Umaishnad b'yom tov desadim lankar Rebbe Yehuda, and he says there is mukta on Yom Tov." So the Gemara answers, "Amri Shabbat dechamir loati lezalzulei be sadim lankar Rebbe Shimon demekel." On Shabbos, it's more machmir, it's more stringent. People will take it seriously. You don't need mukta. Yom tov dekel vati lezalzulei be sadim lankar Rebbe Yehuda demachmir. Now, we're going to come back to this, whether this is actually true. But the Gemara sets forth that there's a basic machlokas. Rabbi Shimon holds that there is no mukta. This is not a thing, it doesn't exist. And Rabbi Yehuda says there is mukta. Now, how do you understand their machlokas? So, one way of understanding it is, if you look at 15, these are from notes from Rulchenstein, from somebody who writes better notes than I do. I think these are also Udi Schwartz's. He's a chashev dude. He's a good guy. He's in share with me. Now he's like, I forget, he's the head of some machlakla in the army for Rabbanut something. B'chol mikre nitan la'vin machloket hazot b'shnei kivunim. There's two ways of understanding Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. One is to say that they really agreed bigadol. They just argue at the margins. The other is to say that they argue about the conception of mukta. Because as we're going to see in a minute, even though the Gemara says Rabbi Shimon doesn't hold a mukta, it's not true. He holds of some muktas. But when he holds of some muktas, why does he hold of some muktas? So one way is to say Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon basically agree. They just argue at the margins. Rabbi Shimon has a little bit less mukta. Rabbi Yehuda has a little bit more mukta. The other way is to say they conceptualize mukta in totally different ways. So this is what he writes: Hagemara omeret so Rabbi Shimon lit le mukta. Right? The Gemara says Rabbi Shimon doesn't hold of mukta. Avol bekama gemarot oleh sheyesh lo mukta machn k'thorn chitz balechaim groger tzimukim. He has all types of mukta. And if you want the list, I gave it to you just to be helpful. In number 20. Right, I gave you from Rav Yosef Farkash. He put a very nice summary of mukta, and he notes the seven places where Rav Shimon does hold a mukta. I'm not going to read it inside, but I'll tell you what they are. Right, the first one is the Gemara in Shabbos Memhei, which says that hukta l'mitzvato. He holds a mukta machmas mitzvah. In number two, Rav Shimon holds of groger than simukim, meaning if you put grapes on your roof to dry, and therefore you don't expect to use them because they're going to be in that middle state. They're not fresh, nor are they dried yet, right? So they're just, right, you know, that bad state of grapes, right? Fresh grapes are good. Raisins are good, right? At least some people like raisins. I like raisins. I know a lot of people don't, but fine, right? But grapes that are starting to, like, wilt, right, or whatever the word is, are bleh, right? So those grapes, Rav Shimon says, are mukta. That's number two. Three, he holds that an animal that dies is mukta. Rocks. Rocks are mukta, except for rocks in a chatzar, which you could use to wipe yourself. A candle, mukta machmas iser, right? Candle that was lit before Shabbos, mukta. Some think that by nafta de misrach, by particularly smelly naft, right? It's mukta. So, and the Rambam holds this way, right? The Rambam, I gave you in 18 and 19. Again, I'm not going to read inside. In 17, 18, and 19, the Rambam writes that he holds, like Rav Shimon, meaning there is no mukta. And yet, in 18 and 19, he tells you about all the different mukta he does agree to, right? Again, I'm not going to read it inside, but you can look if you don't believe my list, right? You can just look. The Rambam holds like this. So Reb Lichtenstein therefore says, he said, so what does Reb Shimon really mean? What does it mean he doesn't have muktza, and yet he does hold of muktza in all these different cases? So, and I'll just say it outside, but I gave you the notes, so you can look back at it. Reb Lichtenstein says, you know what it might be? That Reb Yehuda and Reb Shimon both agree to muktza, but they conceptualize it differently. Reb Yehuda is of the opinion that muktza is a function of hachana. Namely, in order for something to be permitted for use on Shabbos, it needs to be the thing which is either actively set aside or presumed to be set aside. And therefore, his muktza is more expansive. Reb Shimon holds that, look, everything in its assumed state is not muktza. But he agrees with the second type of muktza, namely, makta midato, things that are set aside actively rather than implicitly, are muktza. Therefore, why does the Gemara say that grapes, which I put up on my roof to dry and are now in this middle unusable state, Reb Shimon agrees to? Because he doesn't think you need to actively prepare something before Shabbos to make it not muktza, but he thinks that if something was actively pushed aside, then it is muktza. Why does Reb Shimon hold that muktza machmas iser, a candle that was lit before Shabbos and was on fire into Shabbos, is muktza? Because it's actively set aside. It was engaged in malacha when Shabbos began. Why would you suggest that muktza machmas mitzvah or muktza machmas miyos, Reb Shimon would agree? Because he does hold a muktza, but he only holds a muktza in the active sense. Things that are pushed aside actively are muktza. But things which are not pushed aside actively, they just lack preparation, that he disagrees with Rabbi Yehuda. And the reason that Rabbi Yehuda therefore is more expansive than Rabbi Shimon is because, it's very simple, right? This is very easy. Whenever something is in its neutral thing is usur, you're going to be more forbidding. That's Rabbi Yehuda, right? In the neutral state, things are forbidden because they need active preparation to be permitted. If you think that something only becomes forbidden when you have reason to actively push it aside, the number of cases included are going to be less. So Reb Lichtenstein said the simplest understanding, or not maybe not simplest, the neatest understanding for the difference between Yehuda and Reb Shimon is that they take these different models and it is predictive. Right? It doesn't necessarily work, right? So this is always the problem, right? Is that, again, I hate doing this, but I do it, right? I do it anyways. No, Reb Lichtenstein did it here, so it's okay. I still hate doing it, but I'll do it anyways, right? That's a neat way of working it out. It doesn't always work. Because you could just as easily say, no, that Reb Yehuda and Reb Shimon both think that muktza is about active haktza. And the question is, at what point it's a quantitative difference rather than a qualitative difference, right? It's a scale question, right? At what point is it only at, you know, there are neutral things and then there are things which are like sort of pushed aside, like I'm probably not using them, like 40-60, and then there's 90-10, right? You could just say that Reb Yehuda and Reb Shimon say, look, we all agree that things become muktza when they're pushed aside actively. Reb Yehuda just thinks that even things that are mildly offensive are muktza, and Reb Shimon only thinks uber offensive. You could also say that they both agree the hachana model, and Reb Shimon is just more expansive in what he perceives to be implicit preparation. Reb Yehuda is the more demanding. I need super preparation, and therefore more things are going to be not prepared. Reb Shimon says, look, I think muktza is a function of hachana, but I'm willing to say that, you know, people probably in the back of their minds, unless I have reason to not believe that, were mechan. So yes, it could be that this nice hakira is not true. It could be that it is true. I'm giving you all the possibilities. I'm not poskening. Right, I'm just telling you that these are it. But it is helpful to think in these models, I think, in muktza. Which one convinces you, I don't know. But those are the four models I now have for Yehuda Reb Shimon are, right? There's either the Ramban-esque model, right? Which is, it's not as like predictive. They argue, they don't argue, whatever. I don't know, right? They argue what was a gzera. Or, which Reb Lichtenstein suggests could be the case, Reb Yehuda and Reb Shimon argue along the haktza'ah hachana axis. Or, They both agree to Hachana, but they argue, how demanding do I have to be in terms of defining what counts as preparation? Or they argue on the Haktzah model, which is how Ichsa does something have to be considered pushed aside. Now, how would this explain all the machlokot about Reb Shimon? What does he hold? Which Muktzah? Pick your model, right? I'm not going to, right? Any of those models could work. You know, it's, as Ray Schwartz once said, right? Even if you don't believe in Brisker Lumdus, it helps you organize your thoughts sometimes. You're right, it may not be predictive always. It might be predictive, but you're right. You could always explain it in other ways, but it still helps organizing, and still may be true, even if not, right? Even if you can't prove it, right? It certain Rishonim clearly held certain ways, right? Meiri is clear the way he holds. Rashi is clear the way he holds, right? But it is, I think, a helpful model. Okay. Now, if you want to see someone who formulated this way, go back to 13 for a moment. This is a quote from Rabbeinu Tam with explanation from Rav Meidan as summarized by Udi Schwartz. Okay? Sorry. But there was a question about Shlish Malachdo Le'Isser, right? Is Shlish Malachdo Le'Isser subject to the Machlokes Rehuda Rabbi Shimon? And Rabbi Shimshon, I think this is Rabbi Shimshon of Sens, I think, the Rosh Mishantz, I think it is, asked Rabbeinu Tam, and Rabbeinu Tam responded as follows. Rabbeinu Tam, right, says it's not part of the Machlokas, and he writes as follows. Rabbeinu Tam meishiv le Rabbeinu Shimshon, ki ha'isur l'taltel kli shemach l'isur einenu nogel m'machlokas Rehuda Rabbi Shimon. Rabbeinu Tam einenu mifayer madua. The Ron explains, he says as follows. Right. So another model of it, and this is something we hope to get to, is another way of formulating some of Reb Shimon, is that Ray Turchiner mentioned this in passing last week, that in addition to Muktzah, there is the Gzera of Kalim. Right? There's Gzera's Kalim. The relationship between those two is not clear. It's possible that they're not the same thing. The Gzera's Kalim stands independently of Muktzah. And many of the things that we call Muktzah are not Muktzah at all. They're a holdover from Gzera's Kalim and Nechemya ben Chachalia. If that's the case, the Ron says, one way of explaining Reb Shimon is that he really doesn't believe in Muktzah. What he does believe in is Gzeras Kalim, right? He believes in Gzeras Kalim. Now, it doesn't explain all the evidence, but this is what the Ron suggests. Rav Meidan, another Rashiva at Gush, had noted that the reason this is helpful to think about it in this way is that Gzeras Kalim is much more expansive than Muktzah in the sense that right, kalim have use. Right? Right, they have use. And if you think that Reb Shimon only holds that things are muktzah, if you actively say this is useless, it's weird that he agrees by certain kalim, right, which seem to have a use, and yet Reb Shimon agrees. But if you remember that there's actually two things functioning, which makes this even messier, right? I mean, because what you could come out with is the following. That Reb Shimon holds of two things. Active muktzahs, and why does he seem to hold that certain vessels which are useful are still usher? Because of Xeris Kalim, right? And now, of course, this also, and this is why, even though we paskin, like Reb Shimon, that there is no muktzah, in actual fact, we hold a muktzah. Why? Because by time you cross off the list, the seven times that Reb Shimon holds a muktzah, and all the things that might be a holdover of Xeris Kalim, right? The number of differences between Rehuda and Shimon, halacha lemaisa, is not so great. But that may also explain what Adam noted, which is that there are certain things which are not mukta midaito, and yet Reb Shimon agrees to. It's true, but he may not agree to it because of mukta. He may agree to it because of Gzeiras Kalim. Now, I gave you here. Later on, let me skip to it and say it now. I gave you I gave you Rav Chaim's suggestion that maybe Rav Huda and Rav Shimon argue on the Hachana non-Haktza Midaito model. There are other possibilities, obviously, but I gave you examples if you will hold this. In 26, Rav Asher Weiss, I looked at my notes and I had this in a footnote. I'd made a footnote for myself 11 years ago to look at this line in Rav Asher Weiss. So I had it ready. Rav Asher says that, takes the position that both Rav Yehuda and Rav Shimon agree that muktzah is a function of active setting aside. They just argue in quantity, right? The 60, 40, 90, 10 thing. Right, and that's what he writes. It's katzel barush and echluk v'hol ikur geder muktzah. The Rav Shimon ain't in muktzah el macha adam makzeh dato mimenu akta muchletet. Right, he thinks that Rav Shimon thinks something is muktzah if you push it aside 100%. Ugmura ula olem lo makzeh daito legamre mimidi dechazile. And anything which might be usable, Rav Shimon doesn't push aside. Right, that's why Rav Shimon is less expansive. Aval Rav Yehuda is lina bazar ikur machshavto. Rav Yehuda thinks you go by not anything you might possibly use, you go by main usage. V'kevanshu maksam idaito me'ikr shimushu, and since things which you're probably not going to use, you don't really think about, afshe etzem achefetz chazile daibak tzazu lechadish din mukta. Right, that's sufficient to make something mukta, right? So Rav Asher Weiss, unlike Rav Aharon, says no. The Machlokas Rav Yehuda Rav Shimon is on the Haktza'a axis. They both agree that Muktzah is created by pushing aside. Rav Yehuda thinks it's pushed aside if I think I'm not going to use it. And Rav Shimon thinks something becomes Muktzah if I have no intention whatsoever, absolutely not, I'm going to use it. But if I might, possibly, it could be. So then something's not Muktzah, right? It's a quantitative question of scale. It's also possible that they argue on the Hachana axis. And I put this here I believe I put it from the Rav, right? From the Rav, Rav Chaim quoting the Rav. I may have left it out. But I believe it was from the Rav. The Rav Aharon quoted it, that maybe they both argue on the... I put it in 24 here. In 24, look at the end of 24 here, like the second paragraph on the bottom of the third page. He said, Agrid salavej kevid, sheledad kulam yesh sorech ba'achana chiyuvit. Everyone agrees that you need active preparation. Hamachloket irak b'she'ila ha'im kol davar ra'ui nechshav kemuchan. Their machloket is what makes something prepared. Is it theoretical possible use, or is it specifically put aside for eating, right, for positive purposes? So, again, as a good brisker, I should not tell you anything I just said, right? Because now I've just made it that none of the chakiras are predictive in a chanami, right? But since we have 2 minutes, let me just quickly review it, right? So what is this thing called muktzah? So 3.5 models, right? One is that muktzah is anything which wasn't actively prepared before Shabbos. That's Rashi, that thinks that all muktzahs derive from hachana. Two, things are muktzah if they're actively pushed out of sight, out of mind. That's Meiri. Right, the father of all muktzot is Haktza Midaito of Muktzot Machlokes Mitzvah. Those might have predictive value. Model 3 and 3.5 is that muktzah is a conglomerate of laws that aid in shvus, either in the Rav Yaakov Ariel Ramban sense, that it prevents us from getting to the point where I do too many things which are malacha, non-malacha, but work-esque, or in the Rav's sense, that the obsession of muktzah creates a cognitive state of mind where I know it is Shabbos. What does this have to do halachal ma'isa with muktzah? So, it could be that this is the machlokas Rav Yehuda and Rav Shimon. That the Gemara is presented as if Rav Shimon doesn't believe in muktzah and Rav Yehuda does, and yet Rav Shimon agrees in all these different muktzot which are active. So one way of understanding it is that Rav Shimon holds things are presumed to be mukhan. The only way something is muktzah is if I push it aside. Hence the more egregious violators of muktzah, machmas mitzvah, machmas miyos, things like that. Rabbi Yehuda thinks no, things are presumed muktzah unless I actively prepare it, and therefore he's much more expansive. The Rav said, no, both Rabbi Yehuda and Shimon agree that mukta is a derivative of lack of hachana. Their argument is, how much does it take for something to be considered mukhan? Rav Asher Weiss says, no, Rabbi Yehuda and Shimon both agree that in order for something to be mukta, it has to be actively pushed aside. Their argument is something considered pushed aside if I have no intention whatsoever, 0% chance of using it, or even if I'm probably not going to use it? Rav Meidan's addition, which is, whatever you think about mukta, you have to be open to the possibility that Rav Shimon also agrees to Xeris Kalim, and therefore there are certain things which are usable that are still Asr, we call them mukta, but they're not really mukta, they're holdovers from Xeris Kalim, which is, depends on how you understand the relationship between mukta and Xeris Kalim. So hopefully that gave you a bit of a conceptual background of what mukta might be based on, predictive or not. The rest of the Makaros, I'll record probably 10 minutes, but what I noticed, some of the other sugyot, besides for this big question, which is, do we hold a muksa at all and under what circumstances, some of the other nafkaminas that come out are, do you hold a suffik muksa or not? Right? Is suffik muksa asur or mutter? Right? Which may be a daraisa rabbanan question, but it also might be a question of active hachana versus active haksa. Right? If you think that in order for something not to be mukta, it needs to be actively pushed aside. So if you have a doubt, it's probably mutter. Because if it's a doubt, I probably didn't push it aside. If I need active achana, so in a case of doubt, I leave it in its status quo, which is mukta. So that may explain the case of a suffix. So I'll record like a 10-minute, 15-minute summary where I just go through some of these points. But really what I did in the rest of this was point to a few sugyot, which may or may not be explained by these models. But hopefully these 3.5 models have at least explained the possible conceptual groundings for the different types of mukta we find, some of which we hold up, some of which we don't. And even though we possibly like Rav Shimon, okay. And we'll see that in the coming weeks. But next